This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Right, is your brain switched on? Good, let's go. Welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Hello, thanks for giving us a listen. My name's Dan. This is the place where we head to the furthest reaches of the universe. We get right in the dark, desolate corners of space, and we learn about some of the most amazing, coolest things that are out there, and then we're back within the hour. Nice and simple. Now, today we're talking about energy. What it is, how we store it, how we use it, and why we're all so obsessed with it. Also, because in the UK, anyhow, it's been like the first proper boiling sunny days of 2018, I thought we'd take a look at the hottest place in the whole world for today's Dangerous Dan. And it's a valley in America that's even crueler than its name suggests. So you can hear about that. And we'll chat to an evolution expert all about eyebrows. That's on the way. First, we're building a body with Fun Kids' favourite genius, Professor Hallux. And we're starting with the thing that helps you stand.
Professor Hallux Builds a Body is produced by Fun Kids with support from the Wellcome Trust.
Hello, science sleuths. I'm Nurse Nanobot, and it's time to join Professor Hallux again in his laboratory. Well, he calls it a laboratory. It looks like a load of chimps have gone wild in a test tube factory. What a mess! There are all sorts of bubbling tanks and piles of books, test tubes and all sorts of strange apparatus. And there's a very funny smell. Poo! Brainbox Professor Hallux is attempting to build his very own human body, full of all those gory but very important bits. Let's find out what he's up to today.
So sorry, I haven't got time to tidy up. So much to do, making my very own human body. Today, I'm concentrating on the structure that enables our bodies to stand up. Brilliant bones and the skeleton. Tremendously important stuff. Without them, you'd just be a wobbly, blobby bob. Tell them all about it, Nurse Nanobot. I've got to crack on. So many bones to make, so little time.
Phenomenal facts.
Bones are mostly made up of a mineral called calcium, which is hard and white, a bit like your teeth. The outside of bones is a smooth and very hard layer called cortical bone, which makes your bones strong and hard. Under this hard layer is a spongy layer called trabecular bone. Whilst this layer is still made of hard mineral, it has lots of tiny holes in it, just like a honeycomb, which makes your bones light in weight and allows for a network of blood vessels to carry blood delivering oxygen, nutrients and water to keep your bones healthy and strong. They also carry away waste products and bits of old bone. In many bones, this is where you will also find bone marrow, a thick, squidgy substance that makes 175 billion new red blood cells every day.
I bet you didn't know that your bones made blood. Clever old things, now that we've made our bones, we need to join them all together. And what have you got? Tell them, Nurse Nanobot.
A skeleton. The amazing framework of your body. Just like planks of wood are the framework of a house, the shape of your body comes from your skeleton. The skeleton also protects your internal organs and all the squishy bits. For example, your skull, which is the hard thing you feel when you touch your head, protects the brain. Your spine is one part of your skeleton that's easy to check out. Just touch the centre of your back and you'll feel its bumps under your fingers. The spine lets you twist and bend and it holds your body upright. It also protects the spinal cord, a large bundle of nerves that sends information between your brain and the rest of your body. Ribs are long, thin bones that surround your chest. You have 24 ribs in 12 pairs, although some people have 13 pairs and others only 11. Together with your sternum, the flat T-shaped bone in the middle of your chest, they form your rib cage. If you shut your eyes and place your fingers on your chest, you can count them.
Spot on as always, nurse. Now, as we've got quite a few bones in our bodies, quite often they will meet. This is where we've got joints. No, not like a joint of meat that you might have for a Sunday lunch. I mean joints which allow your body to bend and move. Some of your joints will only bend in one direction. For example, your knee joint can only swing forwards and backwards like a hinge. Others can move in lots of different directions, such as your hip joint, which can move in a big circle. Bones at each joint are connected by tough straps called ligaments, and the end of each bone is covered with a smooth, shiny cartilage which allows bones to slide against each other. Just imagine how hard it would be to move if you didn't have joints. Try moving around without bending your knees or elbows. Careful now. Now try and sit down. Can you get back up again? See how hard it is to move around? I'm just adding the joints in now.
Horrible old anatomy fact.
Trepanning is a word that means drilling holes in your skull, or someone else's. Since the Neolithic period 12,000 years ago, people have been doing this to try to make themselves feel better. We know this because skulls have been found with perfectly circular or square holes cut in them. The funny thing is that surgeons today do similar activity to get to parts of the brain, but modern surgeons call this a craniotomy.
And did you know, nurse, that whilst a baby's born with over 300 bones as you grow, some of these fuse, so by the time you're an adult, you'll have on average 206 bones in your body. And more than half of your bones are found in your hands and feet. There are 27 bones in each hand and 26 bones in each foot. And did you know that we all have a tailbone? You can feel a knobbly bone at the bottom of your back. This is called the coccyx. Carry on, nurse. I'm just winching the arms on now.
Disgusting detail.
It is pretty easy to tell if you've broken a big bone. Your arm or leg might look very wonky indeed. And if you're very unlucky, some of the bone might be sticking out through your skin. Don't worry, though, if it does happen. It's very easy to mend.
Oh, yes. But always go to the hospital, where with an X-ray machine, a bit like X-ray specs, a doctor can look at broken bones in more detail. The first step of treating a broken bone is to put the pieces back in the right place. Once all the bits are in the right place, the bone is then held in place while it heals with a cast made of plaster, plastic or fiberglass. Your body then takes over with all the blood vessels bringing all the good stuff to mend the bone. And bones are very good at mending. And you thought they were just boring old sticks! And now my skeleton is pretty much ready to go. So let's zap it together and let's let the lightning loose! Brilliant! It's worked! My body has a wonderful skeleton! Isn't he a handsome chap now? Although he needs feeding up. He's a bit on the bony side. Next time, I'll be attaching some muscles to these bones so he can get moving. And now it's time for me to get moving too. Hope you can join me in Nurse Nanobot then. Bye for now.
You can find out more about the professor and his body at the Fun Kids website, funkidslive.com.
Builds a Body is produced by Fun Kids with support from the Wellcome Trust.
And you can get loads more Professor Hallock's episodes and find out tons of stuff about why the way your body is the way it is. You can get that on the free Fun Kids app, wherever you get your podcasts from, and you can always listen to them at funkidslive.com. Here's something to get us started. Why do you think we've got eyebrows? I know, a bit random, but it's a science show. That's what we do. I know some people think it's to keep dust out of our eyes when we used to roam about the deserts. I know others think it's to protect us from the sun. My dad says it's so the young'uns can paint them nice and thick like they're slugs. And to be fair to the old man, I've made him sound a lot more ancient than he is. I know he won't be happy, but he's kind of right. That's what they're for. They're to show emotion when you're talking to a whole group of people. We'll find out more about this with an evolution expert in just a sec, so stay there. First, let's have a quick look at the iTunes podcast store, see who has left us a review and want to shout out on the show. Hello to Joseph and Ben Robinson. Thank you so much for listening. They've written on there saying they love learning all the new and interesting things about science on the show. Good, Joe and Ben, I'm pleased. That's the point. Thank you for leaving us a review. Remember, if you've got a science question that you want answered, that's the best place to do it, on the iTunes podcast store. You don't need to just leave us a review. If there's something about the universe that's niggling around in your brain, the best place to ask me, get to that iTunes podcast store, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, write your name, leave us 5 stars, and in the comment box, ask me your question. If it's a good one, be here next week. I might get someone to answer it. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, scientists, they've discovered that along with developing thumbs and having the ability to talk, humans, they've also evolved smoother faces than our ancient ancestors. Now, Paul O'Higgins, he's a professor of anatomy at the University of York, and he was a senior scientist on the research, and he can tell us more. Hello, Paul.
Hello there, Dan. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Now, I'm very pleased to do that.
This is about humans getting softer faces. Where do we start?
Well, this research started about 250,000 years ago. In those days, the world was full of different types of people, and somewhere in there are our ancestors. And what we were able to study was a particular skull with huge brow ridges that sort of really overhang the eyes. And this skull is supposed to be a member of our last group of people before they turned into us, so our last common ancestor of all living people.
Who was that last common ancestor?
Well, we called him Homo heidelbergensis because the first jaw was found in Heidelberg. And from him comes Homo sapiens, which is all the people that we know in the world today.
Is it true there were 6 sapiens at one point?
There could well have been 6 variants. With this one, what we're looking at now, at the same time as he was living in Africa, and there were people who were similar but different, known as Neanderthals, living in Europe. So there's always been a lot of diversity of different types of people on the planet. In fact, now, probably we're more similar than at any time in the past.
Now, you mentioned that our common ancestor, he showed this trait, this kind of bulging forehead which overhanged his eyes. When's the last time we saw that trait in a human face?
Well, these big brow ridges were present about 250,000 years ago. This group of people had very big faces. And then from about 180,000 years ago to about 20,000 years ago, faces gradually reduced. And as they reduced, the brow ridges got smaller and smaller, and the forehead got more and more vertical. The forehead was pointing straight at you rather than sloping away in the distance.
Evolution, it's all about survival of the fittest. Why would having a small head be beneficial to humans in progressing?
Well, first of all, I think we need to go back to this ancestor, because you've asked exactly the question we asked, but the other way around. We asked, why does the ancestor have great big eyebrows? And there's been a few theories about this. One theory is it's just because the face is really big and it sits in front of the forehead, and so you need to fill in the gap with bone, and that makes an eyebrow. Another theory is that the big brow ridges are there to make the top of the skull really stiff, so that when you bite, the face is able to really bite hard into things without breaking. And so we were able to test those two ideas. And then other people have said, oh, maybe the big brow ridges are about telling people about yourself. So there were two experiments that are important here. The ones that we did, where we removed the bone in the computer, so did a virtual operation on the skull, and we found we could take lots of bone away and the face and the skull still fit. So the idea of filling space seems to be wrong. So then the next thing we did was we took away the brow ridge, and we did in the computer, simulated biting. We made the 3D model of the skull bite, and we saw where it was likely to break. And then we removed the brow ridge and found it made no difference to the stiffness and the ability of the face to deal with bites. So that leaves us with the question of what then is the cause if it's not those two main things. We talked to a friend of ours who told us a story about an anthropologist in America called Grover Krantz. In the 1960s and 70s, walked around for a year with big stick-on eyebrows, and he wanted to see what they were useful for. And he said they weren't very good at getting rid of sunlight. They didn't keep his long hair out of his face, or particularly keep the sweat out of his eyes. But what they did do was that when he was walking along the road and people saw him, they crossed the road to avoid him. So that made him think that the eyebrows were telling people that this is a tough guy, get away from me. So they were signalling aggression and dominance.
It's incredible, isn't it? Because if you think of how a smile works, and if you raise both eyebrows when you're smiling, that could be, I'm feeling a bit curious, I don't know what's going
That's exactly it.
It could be, I'm really happy to see you. Maybe one eyebrow lifting is, oh, I'm planning something dastardly. Yeah. Did eyebrows portraying emotion come first, and that's why we evolved them? Or did we evolve the ability to read emotion into eyebrows?
Right, well, I think both of those answers are right. I think in our ancestors, the big brow ridges were used to signal fairly simple things. I'm the tough guy, I'm dominant, I'm the boss, follow me, or I'm not the boss, I'll be part of your gang. But then as our faces reduced, as we moved from hunter-gatherers to being agriculturalists into cities, we don't know the cause, but the face got smaller. And as the face got smaller, something happened for free, which is that the long, low, sloping forehead became an upright, vertical forehead. And the muscles that go down the forehead and connect to the eyebrows suddenly are able to raise the eyebrows rather than just pull them back. And we think that that was important in human evolution because we went from living in small groups of people to big groups of people. And when you live in big groups of people, it's important that you can understand what people around you are thinking, that you can read their minds and know how they're feeling. When we first approach somebody, if we're going to be friendly, we just flash our eyebrows up for a fifth of a second, and that's enough to say, I'm friendly, you can talk to me. Not something we mention or even particularly think about, but we all recognise it immediately. Initially, the brow ridges signalled something simple, and then as the face got smaller, the brows became more mobile and were able to signal more subtle things, and those more subtle things are very important to our ancestors who were trying to build big communities that work together well, where people understand each other. And so I think we probably evolved a lot of this insight into reading each other's minds over the last 200,000 years.
As someone who is a professor of anatomy, you've just managed to have a breakthrough in studying human evolution simply by looking at eyebrows. What still don't we know about the human body and why it is the way it is?
There's a lot we don't know about the human body and why it is the way it is. The work we did on this, of course, used computers and CT scans. So the sorts of images that you get taken in the hospital can now be used for doing research, for understanding how the body works and how it fits together. I think what's coming next is going to be this wonderful period where computers come together with CT scans from hospitals and our medical imaging, and we're going to be able to not only build pictures of our bodies, but also make them work and animate and build avatars. And so understand our body in terms of form and function using all of these advances.
Now, Paul, finally, one of the glorious things about just speaking to you over the phone and being on radio and on podcast is it's a purely audio form and we have to paint pictures in our minds.
Yes.
Talk to me, Paul. What are your brows like?
My brows are not big and hairy. They're small and not very obvious. And so I find that sometimes people don't quite know what I'm thinking.
I've got a perfectly painted picture in my mind of you right now, simply from your brows, Paul. Paul O'Higgins is a professor of anatomy at the University of York. Thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thank you for inviting me, Dan.
It's time to talk about the most cruel and deadly things in the universe. And it's been a hot week over here in the UK, isn't it? Like the first few boiling days of 2018 we've had. So I thought, because of that, we do it. For this week's Dangerous Dan, we'll talk about the hottest place in the world. And it's got a proper deadly name to match as well. Welcome to Death Valley. Now, Death Valley is in the Mojave Desert in the USA in East California, which is on the west coast of the states. And if you go there, in the basin by the Sierra Nevada Mountains, you will find Death Valley. It's a place so dry that almost nothing can live. Water disappears in an instant. It's 3,000 square miles big, it's 86 metres below sea level 2, which is why it's so hot. When that baking sun gets in, it's got nowhere to go, it's trapped. And the highest temperature ever recorded on Earth was in Death Valley. And if you thought that that place had a fitting name, well, get this, a title that fits the bill. The highest temperature ever recorded was in Furnace Creek. Furnace. A furnace is a place, it's a big fire that consumes everything you chuck in it. Old trains used to be powered by furnaces, and back in 1913 the temperature got to 134 degrees Fahrenheit in Furnace Creek. That's 56.7 degrees Celsius, halfway to boiling point. Imagine that. That's a serious danger stand, right? Furnace Creek in Death Valley, the hottest place on Earth. It certainly lives up to its name. It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, you can find out why the Indonesian army have been called in to work on the rivers over there in just a sec. First, we're meeting two aliens, N and G, and they're stuck on this planet. They're marooned on Earth. Their spaceship is broken down, and they're trying to find the power to get back home again.
N and G's Energy Challenge. I thought you were packing the stack of power packs in the back.
I was in charge of the handlebar radar on the sidebar of the space car. You were meant to be stacking the power pack.
Well, if you hadn't been trying to pack 300 cuddly Zoids and your entire collection of Spokatron cards, then maybe you might have realised.
We're going to be stuck on this horrible planet forever. How are we going to get home?
All right, this isn't getting us anywhere. Calm down. There's plenty of energy on planet Earth. You just have to know where to look. Breathe. Breathe.
All right. All right.
Energy is everywhere in the universe, and that means...
there's energy on Earth too.
That's right. There's energy on Earth too. Of course there is. Energy is used for all sorts of things here on Earth, just like it is on planet Zog.
Cooking, keeping warm, powering subparticle laser pods.
Well, the first two, yes, and yes. And they have these things called cars and trains. Not subparticle laser pods, but yes, exactly the same. And hey, it could be worse.
Hungry space dinosaurs?
No, not hungry space dinosaurs. I mean, count yourself lucky we didn't arrive a few hundred years ago. These Earth dudes had to carry their own energy around back then.
You mean they had to pack a stack of power packs in the back too?
No, what I mean is they had to make their own energy when and where they needed it. Normally it looked pretty much like this.
Emergency! Emergency! Hypervolatile explosive gas!
It's just a bonfire, G. For centuries, humans had to use wood or whatever was to hand to create energy. They would burn it to heat their houses and cook food.
And power their subparticle laser pods?
Quite possibly, if such a thing existed, which is doubtful.
Well, not much use, though, is it? We couldn't carry a load of wood around or carry a bonfire back to the laser pod.
Can't argue with you there. Luckily, humans found some other types of energy along the way. Things called fossil fuels.
Hey, maybe we can use them to get home. Let's check it out.
This is a steam train. It's powered by coal. That's a type of fossil fuel. A couple of hundred years ago, humans figured out that deep underground were fossil fuels, like coal, which could be burned to power steam engines, factories, and trains like this.
Wow! Hidden under the ground. I wonder who hid it there.
No one hid it. It just, well, was created there. Oil is another type of fossil fuel. From this sticky black liquid, humans make petrol for their motor cars. And then there's gas. Now that's a much cleaner and more efficient fuel.
Did you say gas?
Not that kind of gas.
Well, our problems are solved. Fossil fuels sound perfect. Just the one to power the stack of power pods in the back. We'll be home in no time.
Not so fast, mate. Fossil fuels have their drawbacks. Not only are they dirty and create a lot of pollution, they're not that easy to transport. And you have to store them safely. And they need oxygen to burn. And there's not much of that in space. Calm down, G. I haven't finished. Using coal, gas, oil, and other fuels to create electricity is a way to make them much more versatile and useful.
Brilliant!
Watch out! Looks like we're gonna fuse, G!
Here it comes! Whoopee! I love a bit of fusion!
Here it comes! Woohoo!
NNG's Energy Challenge. With support from National Grid. Find out more online at funkislive.com/energy.
Right, let's have a look then at all the science in the news this week. The army has been called in to unclog the rivers of Indonesia, which are all blocked up with rubbish. You've got plastic and bottles and bags over there. They're not being thrown away properly, and they end up just clogging all the rivers and the canals which fill the country, which is a big bit of trouble because it's how loads of people get around there. So the army have been called in to come over and to help clean it out. I wonder what they're doing next Tuesday. Maybe they could help with my messy room. Also, a bit of space rock that's been found in 2008 has been discovered to be part of a lost planet from this very solar system. The space rock, it's got diamonds in as well, and after extensive research and years of study, it's found that it was from a planet that existed near ours billions of years ago. And finally, scientists from China are hoping to create limitless nuclear energy with no waste. They've made a whole island dedicated to it. It's called Science Island. And on there, they fuse hydrogen to make helium, which creates nuclear energy. So the future of the world, of our planet, could be powered by Science Island in China. Right, very quickly, before we finish this week's episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly, I want to squeeze in a quick field trip, a little journey. Shouldn't take too long, nothing more than a couple of minutes. But in that time, we're heading back 200 million years to the Cretaceous period.
Travel back in time to the age of the dinosaur.
At the Natural History Museum.
Imagine going back in time, not 100 years or 1,000 years, but millions of years. To the age of the dinosaur. About 145 million years ago, the Jurassic period ended and the Cretaceous began. More dinosaurs lived during the Cretaceous period than at any other. In fact, the world offered a wider variety of environments and species than before.
Uh-oh, we're on the move again.
Hold on tight. Whilst the two main continents, Laurasia and Gondwana, had been slowly moving apart for millennia, during the Cretaceous period, they began to break up to form the continents we know today. Oceans still covered most of the planet, and many low-lying areas were underwater. At this time, you wouldn't have been able to travel from one side of America to the other without a boat. There was a shallow ocean in the middle. As the land broke apart, dinosaur species became separated from one another and had to adapt to new and different environments, from wet, cold and rainy to hot and dry. There were still leafy forests where huge plant eaters like Mutaburosaurus would graze. Mutaburosaurus, which was 8 meters long, lived in what is now Australia, and ate plants like cycads and ferns. And because the range of plant life increased substantially during the Cretaceous period, there was more to be eaten, including the first plants with flowers.
Oh, it's really hot here.
Other parts of the world were much drier, like the deserts today. Dinosaur fossils found in the Gobi Desert in East Asia show animals in the deserts then, just like now, had to be tough to survive. Like the fierce predator, Velociraptor.
There's a pack of them. Quick, let's hide.
Velociraptors were agile dinosaurs about the same height as a man. They ran on their back legs and had sharp teeth for tearing their prey. It's believed that they hunted in packs and had a feathery coat. They may have hunted Protoceratops, a tough quadruped. That means four-legged animal, also found in the Asian continent. He was an early relative of famous horned dinosaurs like Triceratops, but much smaller. Less than 2 meters long, with a bony frill on the back of his skull, probably for display, and a very tough skin that would have been difficult to penetrate. Unlike his later relatives, Protoceratops lacked horns. To help him eat, he had a sharp beak-like mouth, rather like a parrot's, for slicing through the driest and hardest vegetation.
Paleontology, pick.
To help make sense of all the different types of dinosaurs, paleontologists classify each species. Classifying means sorting them into groups on the basis of their similarities, such as type of skeleton or behavior. It's even possible to work out the dinosaur family trees by classification. Travel back in time to the age of the dinosaur.
The new interactive exhibition at the Natural History Museum. Walk alongside life-size moving animatronic dinosaurs and other strange creatures among the smells and sounds of the prehistoric Jurassic swamps and Cretaceous deserts. Find out more at nhm.ac.uk.
But watch out for what's around the corner.
You can do more travelling back in time with our Age of the Dinosaurs series and get all our brilliant science episodes from Fun Kids over on all the usual podcast places, you know, like iTunes. Also, you can get it on your phone or tablet on the free Fun Kids app, and you can have a listen to them all at funkidslive.com. Now, I'll see you next week with another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. And remember, you can listen to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.